Los Angeles was handed this legally binding mandate to build 456,643 new homes.
Right, which is a massive number.
It's huge. And we are 4 years into that timeline now, and the city has permitted just a fraction of that goal.
A very small fraction.
Yeah. But, you know, the most shocking part isn't merely that they're failing to build enough housing. I mean, we kind of expect that. The real story here is where they're failing and who is actually carrying the burden of that failure.
Exactly.
So welcome to today's deep dive. For you listening, our mission today is to examine a really fascinating 2026 policy study. It's titled The Los Angeles RHNA Delivery Gap 2021 through 2029.
Yeah, and to really understand the sheer scale of this gap we're talking about, we have to look at the underlying framework first.
Right, the RHNA thing.
Yes, the Regional Housing Needs Assessment Target. Basically, every city in California gets one of these targets, commonly called RHNA.
Yeah.
And it operates on this 8-year cycle.
Okay, got it.
So for the current cycle, LA was tasked with permitting those roughly 456,000 units.
Which is a lot of units.
It is. If you break that down, it translates to roughly 57,000 new homes required every single year, just to keep pace with demand.
Wow, 57,000 a year. And, well, we are halfway through that 8-year cycle, and the city has permitted a grand total of just 76,430 units.
Yeah, total. Over 4 years.
That is just 33.5% of their prorated target. I mean, they are missing the mark by an absolute mile.
They really are.
So today we're going to explore exactly why LA is missing that mark, look at the geographical map of where the missing housing actually lives, and unpack a what-if scenario modeled in the data that quantifies the true cost of all this bureaucracy.
It's a really revealing study.
It is. Honestly, reading through this, the entire situation feels exactly like a college group project.
You know, that group project dynamic is actually the perfect lens for looking at this data.
Right, because the entire city gets a collective grade based on that 456,000 unit goal.
Exactly. Everyone is supposedly assigned a role.
Yeah.
But the data reveals this scenario where only a couple of group members are pulling all-nighters to do the work.
Well, the rest of the group is just sitting back quietly.
Yeah, just hoping the professor doesn't notice their complete lack of contribution.
Totally. But before we look at the map of who is actually doing the work, we have to look at the baseline reality of what is getting built.
Right, the type of housing.
Because the study breaks down housing delivery by income band, and it reveals this glaring contradiction to the city's official housing plans.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. So the official housing element documents published by the city, they are heavily focused on affordability. Like, that is the explicitly stated political priority.
Make housing affordable.
Right. But the actual delivery rates relative to their specific targets, they tell a completely different story.
Okay, lay the numbers on me.
So for very low-income housing, the city has only met 13.4% of its cycle target.
13%. Yikes.
Yeah. And for low-income housing, it sits at exactly 14%.
So they're barely making a dent in either of those.
Not at all. Then you look at moderate-income housing, and it drops to a dismal 10.3%.
Wait, it goes down.
It goes down. But then the above moderate income band, which is essentially your market rate housing, that has hit 19.7% of its cycle target.
Okay, so it's still behind pace.
Right, still behind, but it is drastically outperforming all the affordable categories.
So what does this all mean for the city's priorities then? I mean, if the entire rallying cry of the official document was to build affordable housing, why is market rate housing the only category even remotely approaching its target?
Well, it really comes down to the fundamental difference between political ambition and mechanical reality.
Mechanical reality.
Yeah, I mean, ambition doesn't build homes, right?
Uh-huh.
Financing mechanisms and legal zoning codes build homes.
Okay, fair point.
Market rate housing is much closer to its intended pace because there's just a really straightforward financial path to get it built.
Because there's a profit motive.
Exactly.
Mm.
A market rate developer essentially needs to secure a piece of land, get a standard bank loan, and show a reasonable projection of future rent. If they can prove the project will be profitable, they get the money.
They just need the math to make sense for a traditional lender.
Right. But affordable housing is an entirely different beast. To build an affordable complex, a developer often has to stitch together this incredibly fragile capital stack.
Capital stack, like different types of loans.
Yeah, multiple funding sources. We're talking about federal low-income tax credits, state-level grants, municipal subsidies, and sometimes philanthropic loans.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they might have 5 or 6 different funding sources, and each one comes with its own rigid timeline and compliance rules.
That sounds like a nightmare to manage.
It is. And if just one of those grants gets delayed by 6 months, or falls through entirely, the entire project dies. So you end up with this perfect inversion of the stated goals. The city promised affordability, but the underlying financial mechanics naturally favored market rate delivery.
Which brings us back to that group project analogy, right? We know the affordable housing isn't getting built because the financing is a total tightrope walk.
Yes.
But to understand why the overall numbers are so abysmally low across the board, we have to look at where this construction is actually happening.
The geographic distribution.
Right, because aggregate permit numbers, like that 76,000 figure we mentioned, they completely obscure the reality on the ground.
Totally. The failure to build isn't a citywide failure. It is an intensely geographic one.
Yeah, the study provides this plan area choropleth map.
Basically a color-coded map.
Right, where darker shades indicate a higher concentration of permitted housing. And when you look at this map of Los Angeles, it honestly looks less like one united city and more like two completely different planets operating under different laws of physics.
It's a very stark visual.
Yeah, the burden of building LA's housing is just shockingly concentrated. Like, downtown Los Angeles is the massive outlier here.
They've delivered 58% of their target.
58%. They are the ultimate group project overachiever, carrying the rest of the class.
Absolutely. And downtown is joined by a handful of other areas carrying the weight. South LA has delivered 19% of its target. Boyle Heights is at 27%. Wilshire is at 28%, and Northeast LA sits at 22%.
Okay.
Together, these specific neighborhoods are absorbing nearly all the housing growth for the entire metropolis.
And then you look at the other side of the map. The study identifies this region we can call the wealth corridor.
Yes.
And this area is essentially paralyzed. Westwood and West LA have delivered just 9% of their target. Sherman Oaks and Studio City are also at 9%.
Very low.
Westchester and Playa are sitting at 7%. And then you have Bel Air and Beverly Crest delivering a staggering 3% of their housing target.
3% is virtually a statistical rounding error. It means development has functionally halted.
Wait, but if this were purely a free market issue, wouldn't developers be fighting each other to build luxury apartments in Westwood or Bel Air?
You'd assume so.
I mean, the demand to live there is astronomical, and the land values are the highest in the city. A developer stands to make significantly more profit building there than almost anywhere else.
You would certainly think that. But the study connects this paralysis to a concept from political science. It's called Olson's Distributional Coalitions Theory.
Okay, break that down for us.
So Mancur Olson was an economist who realized that small, highly concentrated groups can organize incredibly effectively to protect their own interests, even when doing so actively harms the larger, diffuse public.
So how does that actually play out on the ground in a place like, say, Westwood?
Well, in urban planning, that small concentrated group is typically made up of wealthy homeowners.
Right.
They'd have a massive vested interest in keeping their neighborhoods exclusive, mostly to protect their property values and their lifestyle.
And the larger diffuse group?
That group consists of renters, young families trying to buy their first home, and even people who don't live in the city yet but want to move there for work.
So it's a huge group of people.
Huge. But they are completely disorganized. The wealthy homeowners, on the other hand, have the resources, the time, and the political capital to hyper-organize.
I see.
They can afford to hire specialized land use lawyers. They have the flexibility to attend a city planning committee meeting at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday to voice their opposition.
Because they aren't working an hourly job.
Exactly. So they create this spatial concentration of veto points.
It's like, okay, think of it like Los Angeles is hosting a massive crowded music festival.
Okay, I like this.
The gates are open, people are pouring in, and the demand for space is huge. But the VIP section, which is the wealth corridor, has this magic bureaucratic force field around it.
A force field, yeah.
It physically pushes all the noise, the crowds, and the attendees out into the general admission area. The physical space in the VIP section exists, it's huge, and it's heavily desired, but it's legally walled off.
That's a great way to picture it.
So everyone else is getting squished into general admission areas like downtown and Boyle Heights?
Yeah, that general admission area is absorbing the impact entirely because the VIP section has literally legislated itself out of the process.
Wow.
And seeing where the housing is blocked, naturally leads us to the mechanics of why it's blocked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The study doesn't just point out the geographic inequality, it actually weights the specific mechanisms causing this massive delivery gap.
Right. They identify four distinct roadblocks.
Yes.
So if these wealthy neighborhoods are aggressively organizing and hiring lawyers, the massive delay must be because developers are just drowning in endless environmental lawsuits and red tape. Right.
Well, lawsuits and red tape are a massive hurdle, but they actually rank as a secondary roadblock.
Wait, really? Secondary?
Yeah, the primary reason Los Angeles is missing its goal is something far more fundamental. Zoned capacity.
Zoned capacity. Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning that for a significant portion of this housing cycle, building enough housing was literally illegal under the city's zone code.
Wait, illegal? How can the city mandate 456,000 homes but make it illegal to build them? I don't get that.
It sounds absurd, but here's what happened. The city's 2021 housing element was essentially just a promise.
A promise to the state.
Yeah. It acknowledged that the city needed to rezone massive swaths of land to legally accommodate those new homes.
Mm.
But a policy document stating an intention to rezone is not an actual legal change to the municipal code.
Oh, I see.
The concrete legal rezoning didn't arrive until 2024.
3 years later.
Exactly. And even then, it was only implemented partially. So for the first 3 years of this cycle, the city was telling developers to build homes that the existing zoning map strictly prohibited.
That is wild.
The legal ceiling is the true constraint here, not a lack of market ambition.
It's like a highway patrol officer giving you a speeding ticket for doing 60 miles per hour. But the city hasn't actually gotten around to changing the speed limit signs from 30 yet.
Exactly.
You're being penalized for a system that hasn't structurally caught up to its own goals.
And that structural lag is the biggest barrier.
Okay, so that's the first roadblock. What's the second?
The second primary roadblock ties directly back to your VIP force field analogy. Wealth zone immunity.
Ah.
We discussed Olson's theory of how they organize today, but the study references something called the LA Externality Atlas, which reveals that this immunity is deeply historical.
How historical are we talking?
The path dependence of this downzoning traces all the way back to 1908 and also 1986.
1908. Wait, how does a municipal zoning decision made before the Model T Ford was mass-produced legally block an apartment building in 2026?
Because path dependence is an incredibly powerful force in urban planning. In 1908, Los Angeles established some of the very first residential zoning districts in the entire country. The explicit goal at the time was to exclude heavy industry from certain neighborhoods. But the implicit and highly effective result was excluding lower-income residents and apartment buildings.
Creating those enclaves of single-family exclusivity.
Exactly. And once a neighborhood is established as exclusively single-family, the political resistance to changing it becomes entrenched.
Right, because it becomes a baseline expectation for everyone who buys a house there for the next century.
Exactly. And then, fast forward to 1986, Los Angeles passes Proposition U, which was this massive ballot initiative that drastically downzoned commercial corridors across the city.
Downzoned meaning?
Meaning that basically cut the allowable size of new buildings in half.
Wow.
So those historical decisions created the bureaucratic force field. The wealth zones have been legally protected for generations, and undoing a century of entrenched exclusivity takes an immense amount of political will.
Political will that local council members are rarely willing to expend, I imagine.
Definitely.
Okay, so the two primary roadblocks are foundational. The city delayed the actual rezoning, making the math illegal, and wealthy areas possess this historical shield dating back to 1908.
Right.
But what about the projects that do manage to get legally zoned? I mean, they aren't getting built either, which brings us to the secondary and tertiary roadblocks.
Yeah, so the secondary roadblock is CEQA litigation delay.
ECHUA, that's the California Environmental Quality Act.
Yes.
Historically, CEQA was meant to be a conservation tool, right? Like a way to stop bulldozers from paving over wetlands or destroying endangered species habitats.
The original intent in the 1970s was absolutely environmental protection. But over the decades, the mechanisms of CEQA have been heavily weaponized by those distributional coalitions we talked about earlier.
The wealthy homeowners.
Yeah. It is frequently used as a tool to block urban infill housing. The study actually frames EQA litigation as a tax on time.
A tax on time.
And the numbers here are staggering. Just 12 CEQA lawsuits filed between 2015 and 2025 delayed over 14,000 units of housing.
Wait, 12 cases holding up 14,000 homes.
Yes.
The leverage a single lawsuit has is incredible.
It really is. And these lawsuits delayed those projects by anywhere from 1.5 to 6 years.
6 years of delay.
What you have to understand about CEQA litigation is that it is rarely a simple, swift ruling from a judge saying, you know, yes, this violates environmental law, or no, it doesn't. It is a war of attrition.
Because while the lawsuit drags on, the developer is just bleeding money.
Exactly. Imagine a developer wants to build a multifamily apartment building on an empty lot. A neighborhood group files a CEQA lawsuit claiming the building will cause unacceptable traffic impacts or block neighborhood sunlight.
Sunlight, really?
Yeah, it happens. And for the next 5 years, the developer cannot put a single shovel in the ground. Meanwhile, they are paying carrying costs on the land, interest on their loans, and massive legal fees.
That's brutal.
Many projects simply run out of capital and die during that delay. The lawsuit doesn't even have to win in court. It just has to stall the project until the developer goes bankrupt or gives up.
A tax on time, that is perfectly phrased. And that leads perfectly into the fourth and final roadblock, which is the sheer physical reality of building.
Right.
The study calls this the permit to occupancy lag.
Because we spend so much time analyzing the struggle just to get a piece of paper that says you are allowed to build. But a permit isn't a home.
No, it's not.
Once a project is completely approved, past the zoning hurdles, past the neighborhood opposition, and past the 5-year CEQA lawsuit, it still takes 2 to 4 years to actually construct the building.
Right, because you still have to physically pour the concrete, frame the walls, and hang the drywall.
Exactly. The pipeline has a massive built-in delay. So even if Los Angeles fixed all of its zoning laws and banned frivolous lawsuits tomorrow morning, the city wouldn't see the physical results of that policy change for another 2 to 4 years.
That is so frustrating. So the core problem is a lack of legal capacity, an abundance of bureaucratic vetoes, and a massive time tax.
Yes, that sums it up.
Which brings us to, honestly, the most exciting part of this study. Because if we know exactly what is broken, what happens when you remove those barriers?
The counterfactual.
Exactly. The study runs this fascinating parallel universe model based on a very real policy called ED1.
Yeah, so in 2022, Mayor Karen Bass issued Executive Directive 1, commonly referred to as ED1. And this was a monumental shift in Los Angeles housing policy.
And what did it actually do?
It created the very first ministerial path in the city, specifically for 100% affordable housing projects.
Okay, so a ministerial path basically means a developer just has to check off objective boxes on a list, right?
Pretty much.
Like if the zone code says you can build 50 units and your blueprints meet the safety and size requirements, you get your permit. No public hearings, no city council voting on whether they like the aesthetic of the building, and no subjective CEQA reviews.
Right, just pure administrative approval.
That's huge.
It is the fundamental shift. It removed the subjective veto points. It took a highly politicized approval process and turned it into an objective administrative one.
Now what happened?
The results were immediate and explosive. By 2025, just a few years after ED1 was signed, it resulted in roughly 30,000 entitled units of affordable housing.
30,000 units?
Yeah.
Just by changing the approval process from subjective to objective.
Yes.
I mean, that proves the demand and the financing can align if the bureaucracy just gets out of the way.
Exactly. And the study takes that explosion of entitled housing and runs a counterfactual. They asked, what if this ministerial path had existed starting in 2017 at the beginning of the previous housing cycle?
Oh, wow. Holding the rest of the world constant.
Yes. Holding interest rates, material costs, and labor conditions completely fixed. They aren't pretending the broader economy was different. They're strictly pretending the municipal law was different.
Okay, and what did they find?
They calculated that Los Angeles would have plausibly permitted an additional 80,000 to 120,000 units of housing.
An extra 80 to 120,000 homes simply by bypassing discretionary review. That is incredible.
It is. The study anchors this model to the real-world entitlement rate observed under ED1, which averaged about 12,000 units per year.
Okay, so that's where the math comes from.
Right. When you backcast that 12,000 unit rate to 2017, you get that 80K to 120K range. And it's a highly realistic estimate.
Really? It doesn't assume a perfect world.
Not at all. The lower bound of 80,000 deliberately accounts for real-world friction. It assumes that even with a fast-track legal process, half of the proposed pipeline might still stumble when trying to secure those complex affordable housing grants or finding enough construction labor.
Wow. You know, we always hear people complain anecdotally about how bureaucracy slows things down.
Sure, everybody says that.
But this study actually puts a strict mathematical penalty on it. By backcasting this 12,000 unit a year rate, we can quantify the exact cost of administrative friction.
Yes, you can literally price it out.
The price of having discretionary review and endless public hearings is losing 12,000 affordable homes every single year.
It quantifies the invisible cost of the status quo. The housing shortage in Los Angeles is not a natural disaster, and it is not purely an uncontrollable macroeconomic trend.
It's a choice.
It is a manufactured outcome of a highly specific administrative process. When you change the process to allow objective approvals, as ED1 did, the housing immediately gets proposed.
So, bringing this all together for you listening, what have we learned from this deep dive into the LA RHNA delivery gap?
A lot, I hope.
Yeah, Los Angeles is not missing its 456,000 home target because developers don't want to build or because people don't desperately want to live there.
Not at all.
It is missing the target because of a structurally uneven zoning map that forces all the growth into a handful of general admission neighborhoods.
Right.
It's missing it because institutional veto power is highly concentrated in wealthy areas that rely on century-old zoning precedents to refuse participation.
Absolutely.
And it's missing it because the city delayed the actual legal rezoning for years, making the necessary housing mathematically illegal to build.
The core takeaway here is that housing targets written on paper are entirely meaningless if the underlying zone code makes the math illegal.
Yeah.
A city cannot regulate its way out of a housing shortage if it doesn't first take the foundational step of legalizing the housing itself.
It makes the massive success of ED1 incredibly validating, but also honestly deeply frustrating.
Because they could have done it sooner.
Exactly. The city knew how to fix the problem, they just spent decades choosing not to.
The data certainly points to that conclusion. But I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, building on that 2 to 4 year permit to occupancy lag we discussed earlier.
Oh, right, the physical delay.
Yeah. The study notes that the second half of this cycle, stretching toward 2029, will reveal if those 30,000 fast-tracked ED1 entitlements actually convert into completed physical homes.
Because a legal entitlement is just a piece of paper, the drywall still needs to be hung.
Exactly. Consider the physical constraints. We have spent this entire deep dive talking about the legal and bureaucratic bottlenecks to permitting housing.
Great.
And we seemingly solved that bottleneck for 30,000 units with ED1. But if 30,000 affordable units are now legally entitled, and the developers suddenly all rush to break ground at the exact same time, what happens to the physical reality of the city?
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Does the bottleneck simply shift from the zoning board to the supply chain and the labor market?
That's a great question.
Can Los Angeles physically source enough raw concrete, enough tower cranes, and enough specialized labor to build a decade's worth of pent-up housing all at once?
Wow. So we finally figured out how to get the group project graded and approved by the professor, but we still have to see if the group can physically print the paper before the deadline.
That's exactly it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you, keep looking at the data behind the headlines, and we will catch you next time.